Welcome to the 107th Smartcast, released for September 2012. This is the multi-sport podcast for triathletes, duathletes, sportive riders, road racers, time trialists, runners, mountain bikers, and fitness enthusiasts.
Whatever the event and whatever your distance, this podcast aims to make you smarter and faster.
Thank you for downloading this 107th episode. I'm Coach Joe Beer, and I'm joined once again by Martin Crocker of South Fork Racing and South Fork, who's waving at me, but he's only 6 feet away. On the other mic.
Hello, hi, Martin. Joe.
Hello.
Hi, Joe.
Right. 50 episodes at iTunes, so go there, go back to some of the classics, and that's the ones we're not in, the classics. That's the ones where there's... Who else is there? Rachel Joyce, the Raylett brothers. There's one with Simon Smart, one with Dan Bullock. There's loads back there. So go and have a listen. That's right, Martin. Don't jump. Ratings. We need them because it's a new podcast page at iTunes. Some of the previous ratings clearly are no longer there. So if you can add yours, that would be much appreciated, along with your reviews and your ratings. So, the news. What is the big thing in the news that's happened in the last month?
It's got to be the Olympics, surely.
Oh, well done, Mark.
Surely.
Well done.
That's just off the top of my head as well.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay. And what does...
Totes Amaze. I don't know what it means. Totes Amaze is totally amazing.
Oh, right.
But in, like, text form.
Oh, right.
And that's okay. Totes Amaze, like LOL.
Right, okay.
And all that. Okay. I don't know. Apparently something the kids do.
So, it was brilliant. We predicted...
We predicted.
I predicted 58 to 64 medals.
Oh.
And it was 65.
I thought there was going to be more, didn't? Did I say more?
No, I think you said less.
I
think you said 4,205.
Yeah, for everyone that took part. But
all the volunteers as well.
I think I would have to go out on a limb and say when just before it started, I was excited, but just thinking I can imagine it's going to be typically English, where we kind of put on a bit of a show.
Great British, not English.
Typically Great British.
Yes.
And put on a little bit of a show. And then as soon as I heard that someone had lifted, is it the... North Korean flag instead of the South Korean flag at the football, I thought, oh god, here we go. But I was absolutely amazed by it. Very rarely am I lost for words, but the opening ceremony was amazing, and then it just got better from there. So all right, there was a couple of dry spells where you just thought, well, especially the road race when we didn't win a medal, and you
but,
were like,
but then
oh,
that
god.
Was let's face it, the road race is why we have one tactic, okay. And that tactic was clearly obvious to everybody. There wasn't a... Right, plan B is to send Froomey up the road if there's a group, and if Cav can still win the sprint, so be it. There was just plan A, and there wasn't plan B.
No.
And they ganged up on it. And it was... I mean, it was brilliant to see, and it was great to see the crowds and stuff, but it was such a shame that it was kind of, you know, built up to be something which you can't control... that bigger group with that small an amount of riders.
No.
And they just kind of went, okay, you're going to have to tote the group up.
Didn't you think it was slightly arrogant to try and think that they could do it like that? Or do you think that's a massive estimate of their confidence at the time?
I just think it was the one tactic that had been thought about for so long, and there may or could have been the plan B, which is at any point, because... Froomey was in such good
splinter
form.
And send someone up the road.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. If something really goes wrong, right, you've got to go with them and be the policeman, or at least then whittle it down to just being, you know, basically less riders to support Cav, but at least one person's up the front with a chance. Because otherwise, once they went and you just thought, hold on, they're not going to get that gap.
They're not going to get that gap.
Well, you're flogging yourself for no reason. Yeah. And then a couple of, I think then didn't one or two of them peel off at a certain
and bid
point
it out and
just go, we're not going to get them. And that was a shame, because I think we were waiting for then things to happen. But the moment they did happen, and you got the first gold in the rowing,
Yes, it was. Yeah. It was the two ladies.
Yeah, and then it was just from then on.
Oh, it just went bonkers then, didn't it?
It just did, yeah. Your highlights?
My highlights were, I think the triathlon, or the Brownlee brothers, were brilliant, and maybe a little bit boring, I suppose, to think that they could that three of them could just sit there. So the two Brownlees and Gomez could just sit there and just think, right, we're off, we'll see you later. Once it kind of got up, I thought it was amazing. You know, it was pretty much
how hard that bike was pushed.
Yeah,
and how but that see that was where the team tactic did work. Because once it came together, and then it kind of was down to the Brits to work together, and really, I guess really, you know, they were able to deliver in a way that was different to the Cavendish thing, where the team tactic plan didn't come off, but you could tell how good Ali Brownlee was feeling and how they were deliberately trying to disrupt people, because he went off and put a spurt in and there weren't many people that were going with them.
No, they were all
trying to hang on, and when you saw what they looked like on the run, I think it showed that Gomez and the two Brownlees were so better prepared of how that was going to turn out. It was going to be as hard a bike as possible.
But do you think the penalties that they're giving out, was it for Johnny mounting his bike too early or not racking his bike properly?
Too early.
Don't you think that he gained about 2.5 inches and had to wait 15 seconds in a box? Don't you think that's a little harsh?
But then that's a rule. You know, rules have been there about discarding your equipment and, you know, penalising people. If you didn't have a rule, people would be on the bike the moment that they got their bike off the rack. And there's always been a mount line, and most people know it. But most people in an amateur field that can't run at full pelt and jump on a bike can't mount it till they get to the mount zone and then stand on. They're moving so quickly, it was probably four or five centimetres too early that the wheel went over. And because they were, you know, clearly there, that was it. You know, it's a rule, and the rule's got to be, you know, there's a few things whereby, oh, somebody didn't quite make the qualifying grade, or Victoria Pendleton, you know, being alongside and ahead of her sprint sort of lead out too early and got penalised. There's rules there, and they know the rules.
Yeah.
And if you gain a little bit and get away with it, oh, aren't you great? But if you don't, that's the nature of it, particularly when people will have found... would have found out, particularly in the cycling case, that had already happened to the men's team earlier on in the year. So their radars were up that, you know, the commissars were looking at things like that. My favourites had to be...
Don't
look at my email while I've written it down. The 4x100 men breaking 37 seconds. That was just... I was absolutely jumping up and down like a... It was brilliant to just see, you know, how fast they could go. And the women doing 40.8 to break what was regarded to be possibly a doping record for 1985.
Cover your back.
It has been suggested.
Yeah,
it
apparently has been suggested. So.
Rhodesia, that was my highlight.
That was a good watch, that.
How fast is that? No, don't look at... No, you just looked.
I did.
For those that are listening, okay, if you realise how fast he ran the 800 metres, it is 17 point something miles an hour. It is almost 18 miles an hour for half a mile. You know, don't put the treadmill up to that and try and run half a mile when you next go into the gym, because you're not going to do it. But it's only when you see that, and he was running... You know, I think he was great because he just went... I'm going to break that record. And he just went from the gun and he hit the 49 point for the first one and then just
kept going.
And that was just, to me, that was the run, the performance of the whole thing. He just absolutely smashed something that you look at the people that have held the 800 metres and you realise that that isn't a relatively new record that's soft. Running is simple. There's no huge technological gains. There has been a little bit in shoes and things like that, but it's a very raw record. And to take that to almost breaking 100 seconds for 800 metres, you start working out how fast that is.
Yeah.
And even to get a group of people together to try and run that, even
individually.
It's like 12.8 per 100.
Yeah.
I mean, you think 12.8 per 100 If he was alongside the people doing like the 110 metres hurdles, if he came around the bend and they started, he'd be hitting the line when they hit the line. That's how staggering how fast he's going.
It's great. And I tell you what, when he was interviewed as well, what a humble, nice, well-spoken chap that he is as well. Mm. So good
that
on
was,
him.
That was one of them. Mr. Bean moment in open ceremony, I loved that. Just not the carry-on of when he carried on and did a bit more, but the very fact that you heard the John Evangelist track start and then he panned across the neighbours with his finger pressing it. It was just comic genius as far as I was concerned. Phelps, yeah, everything to do with Phelps was awesome. 14:31 for the 1500 metres swim by the Chinese athlete. I mean, that is staggering. 14:31.
And she's 16.
No, that was a male.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, sorry, that's a male.
Oh, I got asked, was it the guy off of James Bond? Zhao. He looked just like him. Anyway, next one.
Okay, Martin, I don't know where you're off with that one. No. Michael Johnson and John McEnroe, two people I could listen to commentate and talk about things till the sun went down. Brilliant, absolutely brilliant.
Michael Johnson, you don't expect such a deep commanding voice to come out of a man when you look at him, and he just comes out with this deep voice. It's amazing. So let me just click back on that. Sorry, Joe.
Okay. what was the other thing? What I didn't like, firstly, that it's over.
Yeah.
Secondly, Muppets taking flash photos of Tom Daly diving. They know it's banned at diving, and they do it. You know, it's like, come on, this is his golden moment, and you take flash photography. Muppet. Anyway, sorry. The Muppet Blazers, yeah. Do you hear about Usain Bolt wanting to have that baton when they broke the world record?
Yeah.
Okay. Some Muppet Blazer said, no, you can't have it, and took it away from him.
You don't. Do you know who I am? That's what I would have done. Do you know who I am?
Well, not even that. It's like, look, that's what does that cost? Forget it.
Well, they had to give it to the ladies to run, didn't they? Sorry, can't we? It has to be the women's relay. Imagine him do that. Yeah. No, we've only got.
We've only got eight.
Yeah. Oh no, terribly sorry.
That's why if you drop it, we've all got to run backwards and find where it is. I just thought it was Muppetry. Absolute, such bad PR, you know, that they had to do it. Having to decline Friday evening tickets for the Athletics. But I've got a beautiful baby daughter in return, so it's not a bad swap.
Whoa, you swapped your tickets for a baby?
No, not precisely. Yes. Not precisely.
Congratulations, Mr. and Mrs. Beer.
And Vicky Pendleton not getting sprint gold. It's just a shame she went out on a dive rather than on a, you know, because it was a shame because she'd set the agenda to say, I am finishing then. We don't know with Bolt. Chris Hoy is likely to ride Commonwealth.
Didn't he?
You never know. He might be back for Olympics. You never know. But she's kind of defined that as the end, and it didn't go exactly to plan.
Yeah.
And it can't do. It's not. You know, it wasn't a performance that she was one on one with somebody. And there's always tactics, and you can argue. You know, the tactics of both sprinters either way. But what a phenomenal,
and I
phenomenal
think,
period.
Yeah, I think with Vicky Pendleton as well is Anna Mears. Turned round and just said she's one of the most formidable opponents she's ever had and almost thanked her for the kind of gracious way that she accepted her silver medal. And as if to say, Vicky turned round and said, you know, she won it, it's done, you know, cheers, I'm off, waving. And she just turned around and said, well, you know, I'm utterly, you know, utterly thankful for what they've done, for what everybody's done helping her out. So, good on them.
Yeah, I think it exceeded people's expectations. It showed, you know, the best of physical performances. There was plenty of world records. There was plenty of things which I think just stunned people with performances. You know, Bolt's performances were stunning. They may not have been world records all the way round, but they were still stunning performances.
I tell you what bugs me. Is how fast can that man actually run if he ran the whole 100 metres?
Well, but you saw that. But in the relay, he did. You saw he was side by side with, was it Gatlin? No, who did he run against?
Gatlin.
No, probably wasn't Gatlin.
Wasn't it one of the Bahamas?
No, it was against the American.
Was it American, was it?
Yeah. I'm sure it was. Anyway, he was there, and they were side by side when they took their batons on.
Wasn't gay then.
It might have been, I don't know. But yeah, if you watch that and you see they are side by side at that point, and he just
takes off.
He just takes off. And he did win by leaning and running full pelt. And that's the first time you've seen him actually go 100%. Because in the 100, he still didn't actually, you know, he didn't lean in. He didn't really have to give it full blast. But in the relay, that's what was so amazing. He took it off. And instead of staying at the speed that everyone else had gone round the 400, he just suddenly shot off at a different speed to everyone else. And that was staggering. I mean, 36 seconds to go round 400 metres. I mean, you need a bike for that, don't you?
Well, I would anyway, but there you go. But no, I was absolutely... It was...
But what lessons did you learn, Martin? Because we've got to pass over something to our listeners.
from the Olympics?
Yes.
Yeah, you haven't got enough hours in the day to watch everything.
That's good, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think sometimes what you have to do is look at these things, at people's personal performances, whether it's a sport that you do, a sport that you don't do, and just look at it and think, well, you know, like Tom Daley, for instance, I think everybody in the country would have willed him to win a gold. And I've never seen a man so happy to get a bronze medal.
Yeah, yeah. Because of pressure, I was listening to, because he's Plymouth based, I was listening to the local news, which may not make it outside of Devon and Cornwall.
Oh, no, it won't.
But he was talking to one of the hosts, and he was basically saying, you know, I hadn't even said to anybody bar myself how much pressure I was under.
Yeah. Oh,
said,
yeah.
Because I couldn't even really say to myself how much it was, because it was such immense pressure. And that was the relief, you know, and that was the reason why it didn't matter. It was a medal.
Yeah.
You know, and you look at the totals that that guy dived for first and for second.
Oh, yeah.
They were phenomenal.
Well, they were over five. Were this in 550?
538.
Yeah, yeah. Or 500 is the mark, wasn't it? They think it was going over. And then when they beat it. But no, I think sometimes you need to look at stuff like with the sacrifice that people have to make for the Olympics, 4 years, you know, and when, I suppose a bit selfishly, when you have to make the sacrifice to put the training in for Ironman, I think you need to be massively, massively thankful to the people that support you.
Yeah.
To say, look, you know, this is what I've committed. This is what these guys have helped me with. And when it's all done and dusted, I think we a lot of athletes got a tendency to have gone, well, I did brilliantly there. Well, they then need to turn around and say, you know, these guys have helped me out. I think if you take all the athletes, the cyclists, the triathletes, that all of them, I think from that background, have mentioned their support that they've got. Yeah. You know, the staff, backroom staff, everything. You just don't get that off of football players, do you?
No.
But also, you know what I mean?
Also, a lot of amateur cyclists, triathletes, runners, etc., sometimes forget that people that are volunteering aren't there because they think these people are so wonderful and doing it. Most of us are doing it at such an amateur level that, yeah, we might think it's a wonderful performance, but actually in the grand scheme of things, it's relatively mediocre. You know?
I know
it's hard
feels.
Work, and it's still puts you in a very tiny percentage of people that do any type of athletics. But they all said volunteers were brilliant.
Yeah.
It was amazing, this and that. And I think to actually realise who actually allows you to step up and do your Ironman, the people that have, you know, helped you at work, your family, your training buddies, the physio that got you in at times when they were too busy but you had to be seen, and all these other things, that's what I think the professionals realize. And a lot of amateurs get a wake-up call one day where lots of things around them start going belly up, and what they don't realize is for so long things have been right and they've never been saying to people, thank you, or no, I'm not racing now, I'm taking 2 months off and it's time for me to, you know, clear the attic or really get down to that project at work and do it.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's these people do it because they're not only amazingly talented and hardworking, but it's their job.
Yeah.
And some people turn amateur sport into a second job, and it's very rare. Yes, some of them would have started at age group races, but most of them didn't. Most of them didn't suddenly pop up and say, oh, I'm going to start to, oh, do you know what I mean? I'm going to go for a gold medal. They were already on a different trajectory. Like the Brownlees, you know, they, at a very young age, far earlier than lots of people even now that are in triathlon, were actually even in triathlon, these young junior tiny kids were already showing that they were devastatingly good.
Yeah.
And on the run, particularly.
Good. Well, it's the same with Laura Trott, wasn't it? Laura Trott went to one of the British Cycling Go Ride events. She won by such a massive gap in her age group, they dragged her straight off to, and put her on the elite performance.
Yeah.
So...
Yeah, but I think my lesson was the whole... I think it was the whole, not the marginal gains thing, because that's all over the place.
Marjorie Gaines. She there.
Yeah. I think it's the way in which people take the ups and the downs and the, you know, some people are always the victim of the, oh, well, you know, this has happened and that's happened and I can't do this and can't do that. And some people just say, oh, yeah, you know, SH1T happens from time to time. But, you know, it's happened to other people. I'm just going to get on with it. And there was varying people that some people, even with medals or great performances, still were a little bit like, oh, yes, but if this hadn't happened, I would have got this, this and this. And other people were just like, I did everything I could, and that's great. And some of them did as best as they could. I was thinking of the two rowers who were so despondent that they didn't win.
Yeah.
And yet actually you could see they were absolutely annihilated by how hard they went.
They turned themselves inside out.
That's it. You know, if you gave... as best you could, that was it.
And that's, say it. 110%.
Don't say it. Don't say it.
I knew you'd say that. But yeah, and I think it's quite humbling as well how emotional, I think, kind of everybody felt with when people did well or if they didn't do well. I think it was just like from a whole... country perspective. Yeah. I was just absolutely amazed how everybody got on board with it.
I've spoken to people who just said, I'm quite down about it. And I said, yeah, what I noticed...
I've got cold turkey.
Yeah,
you know,
no,
all
what
over.
I noticed was that it was actually quite... Each morning there was something positive about, you know, you know, this dressage person has got through to the next round, or, you know, this 800 meter runner has made, you know, she's made the final, or whatever it was. There was some positive spin to things. What you look at, there was very little bad news around at the time. There's a few horrific things that made the news, but most of the news was relatively calm. The moment that the Olympics finished, all this kind of like, oh, we have to fill in the gaps now, what do we do? You start getting all this bad stuff about, I don't know, you know, I won't even mention things, but things that you kind of think, if that happened and Bolt was running, it wouldn't have even got on the front pages, let alone be the major thing we talk about. And I have made a conscious effort to think, I'm going to watch what I watch and what I listen to and read, because you can really get affected by the negativity that is normal media.
Yeah.
And you can watch great things and inspiring things and actually feel really good about stuff.
I think that's it in a nutshell, is... You spend probably three quarters of your life reading horrific things. And I don't think you should ignore them. But what I'm saying is your life is then consumed with recession. The country's in recession. Recession was mentioned twice in the whole time that the Olympics was on. And I think it had about 10 seconds airtime. Mm. And that was it. Right, back to the next gold medal. Now... You know, what was the overspend on the Olympics? It was three times over budget or something daft, wasn't it? I would gladly give
a pound.
I would gladly pay tax. No, you know, I would be happy for the Olympics to be here every 4 years. I'd love it, but you know, it's never going to happen. But I'm just glad in my lifetime that I have seen things, you know, sporting things, because that's how I'm driven. That's how I look at things. In my lifetime, to tell my children.
I see the other thing is my five-year-old son, as I've said, about writing on my office, not on the wall, on the whiteboard.
Yeah.
Michael Phelps, enjoy your diving and be very careful at it. Will you send me a message? And he's been watching stuff, and he's been running around the garden and pushing his bike around the garden saying... I'm Blake. No, I'm Bolt. No, I'm Phelps. And kind of running around the garden. You think that's the thing that it you know, it shouldn't inspire kids to say, you know, we've got to search for new medalists. No, let a lot of people just be happy not having to be athletes. They can be other things. But the fact that it kind of percolates so many different levels of people, and when it stopped, one person who's a triathlete I know actually said, I'm really quite down about it, actually, because it was so uplifting and inspiring. Yeah. And now it's kind of, it is cold turkey, as you said. And certainly watching the Vuelta isn't going to do it, is it? I mean, I've watched a bit of it, but it was like, you know, it's not the Tour.
Yeah.
And it's not the Olympics. So it's kind of like, you know, it's the third bridesmaid down the line type thing.
That's it.
Not really.
I suppose it's enough to get you your fix, isn't it? Then for you just to go, oh, it's on. I'll watch the highlights.
What do you reckon then, Vuelta? What's your thoughts?
Vuelta.
Is Froome going to do it?
I would say probably not.
Ooh.
I don't think he will.
Ooh.
Just purely because I don't think the team's strong enough. But I would probably look at Contador. I'd have a sneaky look at him because he doesn't look too shabby at the minute. So he's extremely clever. That's the thing with him, is he'll look for other routes. If he doesn't think he can win it in the mountains, I don't think he'll lose so much time. That'll be way off of it. But I think there's other ways, like when he nicked the, a 3 or 4 second time bonus yesterday, stage. You know, he's looking at maybe coming in through the back door. Sounds a bit strange that he's just kind of, but I don't know. I don't think he's a million miles away.
Okay.
So, but there you go.
Nice insight.
Anyway,
look at that. All very close.
Olympics wise, just let it go now. Just got to let it go, haven't we?
So, podcast tip. Here we go then. Here's a podcast tip. Because you're not going to find a podcast for me.
Do you know what?
Alternate the things. Right. Okay, firstly, set yourself up a pre-race warm-up list of tracks or a pre-high-intensity training session type set of tracks that really do, you know, they're uplifting. There can be Audio Fuel have just done one which you can get through the Twitter feed where there's a click, and it's got all this background kind of commentary from the Olympics, and it's brilliant. You kind of get goosebumps about this, and it's Farah, and he's almost there, and he's doing, you know, and it's all those things. And whatever it is, some tracks should put you into the mindset to say, I'm up for this.
Yeah.
And you were playing a track to me just before we started. You went, oh, I really like this.
That's right.
That's the sort of thing that you have to play. And we've all got our little tracks, which to some people, they might say, oh, not that row. Or, oh, what's that? And I think to captivate that into a CD or something you play in the car, or something you've got on your, you know, your iPod,
yeah,
just a way of using it. And then at the other end of the spectrum, a set of sort of chill out tracks that sometimes just when you want to relax and you don't just go, oh, I'll just tell you, no, I'm going to put my chill out tracks on and just kind of chill. Because one of the things that elite athletes do very well is they're good at switching off when they need to. If they don't need to be watching the television and they need to chill, they will do it, and they will do it very well. Whereas sometimes I see the amateur athlete, either they say, oh, I never watch television, and think, well, that's a stupid idea, because there's great things on television, like the Olympics was.
Yeah, yeah.
But you also have to kind of vary it from time to time. And if you've got that other option to say, oh, actually, I'm just going to sit down, put my headphones on, and just listen to stuff, that can be a great way of just recovering. You know, one way you recover, one way you lift yourself up.
Well, it's true, because you've got songs that invigorate you, that get, you know, you can get the last kind of ounces of effort out. But also with the flip side is, I hate doing the warm downs. It's an essential part, but I just find it boring. It's boring. You know, I've just done all this hard work. Literally all I want to do is get off this thing, or get home and just kind of crack on with what I have to do. But the chill out bit, I did it the other day, just had a little selection of songs where it's just a 10 or a 15 minute warm down after the hard effort. And normally I get halfway through and go, right, I'm just going to slow down, have a drink, and then get off, mop the sweat up, and off I go. But I just sat there, and I think it went on for about 20 minutes because I was too busy cycling, kind of sat up and then looking at things, and then certain songs kind of fire up a thought pattern where you're just sat there going, oh, right, yeah, well, I remember when we went there and had a bit of a laugh, and this is where this song comes from. Mm-hmm. And you just sit there and you slowly pen them for, you know, it 20 minutes is gone.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
you know, the 5 minutes or the 10 minutes that normally took a lifetime is rattled on to 20 minutes, and you know, you're down to a really slow, soft pedal. And
so we've got warm up, psych up, then we've got chill out, kind of, you know, just chill it, although never on the road with both headphones on. Take note.
Yeah.
And then kind of a relaxed one where you just, you know, you sit down, you get on your sofa, or you know go to bed for your nap, and you just play the tunes and just zonk out, because music is a lot of different things. And I think sometimes people don't see that.
Is there a song about that? Music is a lot of different things.
I don't know. It probably is in your house, but it isn't in mine, I don't think. I haven't got that track. I have to just search on iTunes, should I?
But no, I think you're right. And I think how many people that listen to this can honestly turn around and say that when they finish work, they've done a training session, how many times have they actually just maybe even got out of bed, got up from sleep, and then just sat there and just gone for 10, 15 minutes, I'm just going to sit down and just listen to a bit of music. I haven't done it for ages. Sun's out. Might even go and sit in the garden, or you'd sit on the decking and just have a
chill,
small drink with you and probably gin at about 9 in the morning now, and a magazine and just thumb through. I don't even read magazines sometimes with music on. I just thumb through them.
Looking at the pictures as per usual.
yeah. Spot go shopping again and just chill out. Not a lot of people do that now. So I think sometimes it's just nice, even on a day off, to cut it off, go sleep, wake up, listen to it before you go to bed. Chill out.
There we go. Top tip.
No rush. There's no rush.
Went for longer than I thought it would, but anyway, here we go. Right, got a few little tweets, little things that people have sort of sent us or asked us. One person, this was a little while ago, Mr. Ian Panting said, what improvements do you see in Q-Ring users? More power, lower lactate, etc. Have you seen ramp improvements? So Q-Rings are one of the brands of what I would call off-round rings. So they're not perfectly round, and they're certainly increasing in visibility, popularity, and I think in people's acceptance of them. You know, the medals in the TT, in the Olympics, I think at least three, possibly four of the top of the four of the six medals were won by people on off round rings, I think.
Yeah.
I looked at the 50-mile time trial championships this year. I think four of the top five were on off-round rings. They're not, you know, they're no longer like, oh, well, I think I might have seen Carlos Sastre use them, or I think I might have once seen somebody with a set on in mountain bike. And they're actually getting more and more prevalent. Yeah, yeah. In terms of what improvements do I see, I don't think within the margins of what you're going to measure, you can often isolate somebody specifically enough to say, oh, we've definitely
there it is.
We've definitely,
oh,
look, look, we can see there's, you know, there's three more watts of the lab stuff. There's an improvement to be had of the riders that are using it, particularly those that are connected with things like marginal gains and top teams. They're not using it unless they've got some pretty solid data that they may have done themselves in-house. They may have just looked at all the stuff that's around and gone, there's something in this. I just think it's the suck it and see scenario.
Yeah.
You try it and people just go, whoa, that just makes such a difference. Like, great. If you notice there's a difference, we may not be able to absolutely measure that, but I've not known anybody go slower using them.
No.
Say, oh, they definitely don't work. One of mine did once when I got it on back to front on the inner ring, and my legs were doing one thing when I was on the small ring and another on the big ring. And I thought, oh, something up today.
one leg longer than the other.
Monkeys at Southall, put them on back to front again.
I've tried them. I've had a set, and to be fair, to start off with, I was like that. I'm really getting on with these, but you have to almost tinker. You almost have to, because there's a couple of different settings that you can have them on.
Yeah.
So you. I switched the settings, and it was fine. Now, funny enough,
from disco to house.
Yeah, that's it. Straight over, fast as you can. I borrowed a mountain bike with them on.
Yeah.
And we've done a couple of 4-hour rides, and I've noticed the difference with them. But before I wasn't told that they were on there.
So
I was pedaling going, well, it feels a bit strange, but it's a bike that I didn't know. So I thought, oh, it'd be all right if I got on. And I thought, oh, they've got keyrings. Oh, they've worked. That's worked really well.
Yeah.
And then did a TT at the weekend with a set on and realised again that I didn't take a blind bit of notice, borrowed this bike, set it up and did a ride on it. I thought, oh, that's, it just seems to feel a little bit, I'm a bit smoother on it, and then realise, well, I've got key rings on, and it's not the fact that I don't know what's going on, it's just the fact that I literally got on this bike just to race it, set the saddle height, made sure the clip-ons were fine, and then realised they had key rings on. Yeah. So we've seen a lot of guys come in, buy them, take them away and go, right, I need another set. Training bike from a race bike, for the new bike that I've got. So,
and I don't think it's this thing whereby, well, firstly, you hit the nail on the head. You know, you don't have to be super trained on them. I think there is the tweaking bit
that
some people play around with, depending on whether they're TT or road, how they pedal, what sort of terrain they're using it on, which can make a difference. So I think, Ian, it's one of these things where...
It's not measurable, is it, really?
It's not ultimately measurable unless you spent... Within the realms of the up and downs that happen with people day to day, if you're looking at, 2% or 3%, well, most of us are up and down anyway within that variability. So to pinpoint it will take a heck of a long time. You put them on, there's this 30-day money-back guarantee.
That's right,
If you don't like them, send them back. And everybody that's had them, bar for... one person that wanted them for crits and then found they didn't like them for crits but has now got them on their TT bike. And so it just proved that perhaps in some scenarios people don't quite like it, but that's because it's a different type of riding and maybe the person didn't like what they felt like because there is this kind of increase of pressure and decrease. But I think if you try them, you tweak them slightly to your riding, and you understand what you're trying to do with them, there's no reason why it should be round. We are not pedaling circles, to paraphrase Jeff Brooker, probably the most knowledgeable force pedal researcher in the world. We are not pedaling circles. We are pushing down, and the upward leg is trying to relax and get out of the way.
Yeah.
So why should it be a perfectly circular motion? You look at cams on typically on engines, those kind of funny shaped kind of things. They don't do everything circular. There's kind of a different shape to it to give it a different moment of momentum. And I don't fully understand where the exact point should be. And I don't think anyone does. And hence you need to tweak it.
That's it. Yeah.
But it makes absolute sense that when you're at the strongest point and you are pushing down, you want there to be a bigger gear. And when you get to vertical cranks, i.e. at the weakest point, you don't want there to be the same gear as there was when you were strongest. And on the road, up hills, off road on mountain bikes, people say, wow, they come into their own because you've got the sense that you're powerful when you need to be and you don't get bogged down,
overloaded with it.
I think
you have to have some ounce of flexibility with it as well. You have to you have to be able to adapt. And I mean, I noticed from being in a time trial position to a road position, they weren't supposed to be in the same position.
Right.
I switched them around, which meant that on a road bike, they didn't load me up quite so much. Yeah. But again, this is all personal. Just because I had a little toy on it, it just seemed to work loads better. So,
other things, which relate to tweets. Somebody asked me about... I put a little link to some research about a 1500 meter runner. This was research done by the English Institute of Sport. It's currently published in the International Journal of Sports Physiology and Performance.
What was that?
Yeah, there's only three pages of it, but it's
only
super. It's super detailed, and it looks at the physiology of a runner. A runner at 3:38 for 1500, who over the course of this 2-year coaching study dropped down to 3:32, so took 6 seconds off. And if you remember that the gold medal in the London Olympics was won on a 3:34, and the top nine were 3:36 or less. So, it put him from being kind of competitive to competitive.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was very interesting because they're looking at an athlete that they got the data before, then they started working with the coach and athlete saying, this is what you want to do. And it didn't actually happen. For the first year of the study, where there was an improvement, the athlete still failed to what they actually said was, in the first training year, low intensity training was found to be above the prescribed level. So even an athlete at that level was still running too fast on the lower intensity training. So this is that, you know, this is a classic thing that people always think is happening at the age group level. Oh, it always goes too fast in base training. Well, this, you know, elite runner was doing it, and we don't know the communication level, the reasons why, but once they started looking at lactate levels, getting polar heart rate data, they were just saying, you're running too fast for your base work. The athlete was training something like, you have to kind of go into the numbers and work it out, it's probably training about 70 miles of running per week. On top of that, there was drill session, there was some strength work. So, you know, not the, you know, not the kind of marathon runner of 100 miles to 120 miles, you know, 800 meter runner doing about 70 miles a week average per week.
Oh, right.
Over the whole year. But, you know, there's other stuff that wasn't categorized, like, as I say, technique drills work. But in the even in the first year that they were being studied and were meant to be doing stuff, they only did 20% in zone one. By the second year, that because they said there was a point at which they kind of said they did regular feedback, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and they had a change in the resulting modification of training in year two. It reconciled the inaccuracy in training, because they basically they did more low intensity, less medium intensity, and a subtle increase in the amount of high intensity training performed. So without even asking, the athlete's top end work got better, well, because they weren't training too hard at the bottom end. And that's the problem with low intensity training, is that it isn't so low that your body doesn't notice it. So it's still coming out of the bank, and therefore when you go and do the high intensity stuff, you can't do it. So the runner was actually running faster during specific interval sessions, which they'd monitored by doing blood lactate levels, because so they could see that actually their sort of steady state improved. Even though they were doing more base work, they actually got better at steady state lactate running. And so by the second year, when they were doing it properly, they were up to over 55% of the training was now in zone one. So I calculated it to be something like there was only 13 miles of base training in year one. And then there was about 40 miles by the second year.
Crazy, really, isn't
it? So three times the amount of base training, and the athlete improved a greater percentage than they'd ever improved before. So, you know, it goes back to this whole thing that, you know, that firstly, an athlete has to do, you know, what they call it spot checks. I'd call it lie detectors. But you download, you download and say, are you running at the pace you should do? And some people say, oh, yeah, I was a little bit over the top of zone one. Well, then that's an incorrect session. If you're doing base, it's easy. If it's not, then you've got to take whatever you did that was too hard and take that out of your hard training bit. Because you can't go into that, oh, yeah, I didn't do much base work. It was all kind of middle and upper work, because it doesn't work. It, you know, might give you a quick ego boost, but it doesn't work. When you look at it, I reckon the athlete was training about 650 hours per year. When you look at the strength work, the running and how long that was taking, the skill sessions and stuff, but 600 plus hours. It worked out that... for about 3,600 miles of running, that allowed them to take 6 seconds off.
But like you said at the start, that's the difference between being good and a gold medal winner.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So for that kind of person.
But it was it was interesting that they didn't present the data on their mass, but they presented it on their VO2 and their VO2 per kilogram. But if you divide one from the other, you can work out how heavy the athlete was.
Yeah.
And the athlete was actually 1.3 kilograms heavier at the end of the study.
Ah, right.
And yet still their VO2 max climbed from 70 at the start up to 78 milliliters per kilogram by the end. You know, and there's always the touted number of Lance Armstrong was up around 85 or whatever, and this athlete was up at 78, and one of the tests they got 79.
Yeah.
But they've actually got heavier. Most of the time when people look at running, they always say, you know, you've got to watch that you're not you're not heavy and that makes you slower at running.
Well, yeah.
Typically that would be, but probably because this athlete could do high intensity work
better yeah.
absorb their training better, because instead of 20% base, which is pretty pathetic, they were able to do over 55% base. They were absorbing the training, so perhaps the strength training was more effective
yeah,
and it allowed them to absorb and get stronger. Certainly the high intensity stuff was shown to be of a higher quality by the second year, because they weren't going too fast in the base stuff, but they actually increased their mass and yet still ran faster. And most of the time people think about, oh, well, you've got to be as light as possible.
Yeah.
Whereas this athlete didn't. They actually had to do the base stuff right in which to improve. And it, you know, in three pages, you kind of think there isn't a lot there until you start breaking down the data and looking further. And it just proved that, you know, even somebody that's running a 3.5 minute effort, okay, is still doing, you know, they said about 70 miles of running a week. There was strength training, there was drill work, and there was stability work. We don't know exactly what that was, but, you know, it wouldn't have been the equivalent of another 70 miles of training.
Yeah.
But it was something to add on to that. And yet, they kind of were very high performance, but by changing a few things, and the most obvious thing was they made more base training, actually base training, rather than faster than it should be. By doing that, they got quicker,
yeah.
which, you know, to think about that, you think, yeah, that's where the easy stuff comes in. You've got to do the quality.
Yeah.
And there was some discussion of what sessions they did for quality monitoring and stuff. But it was really a case that, if they were only doing 13 miles of base work, it was making them slower. Whereas when they upped it to 40 miles of base work, they went faster.
But like you were saying, it was only three and a half minutes effort, but surely the margin to get your training wrong is greater.
Yeah.
Or,
yeah.
Is detrimental if you get it wrong.
Yeah.
Because there's less to play with, if you know what I mean. You've got to get it right.
The rowers are typically, okay, they're doing a non-impact sport rowing, but, you know, rowers are certainly, they're up around 1,000 hours a year, ugh. Certainly 800 to 1,000 hours a year of training, and they're doing a 6.5-7 minute effort.
Yeah.
And again, it's so high lactate, and yet a massive amount is base training. And people that do, you know, your kind of 10-mile time trials, the half marathons, Olympic distance triathlons, are trying to do too much high-intensity work, and they're doing something
yeah.
that's taking 20, an hour 20, 12 hours 20,
yeah.
and they
yeah.
don't realise that a little bit of quality work clearly helps, but you've got to have the base there and be economic and efficient, rather than be thinking, oh, the way to get quicker is to do, you know, I'm not going to do that slow training, it doesn't work for me. But that's complete rubbish.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, this person who's at elite level needs to do more base work. So, yeah, it was really, to me, it was really interesting.
Yeah, no.
As you can see,
Joe's showing me the 3 or 4 pages that he's got there, where he's highlighted it, done pie charts, and is that your own graph on there as well?
Oh. Right.
No, the next... Oh, no, sorry, it's printed on there.
No, I had to use their graph to work out the numbers and stuff. But, you know, it's good to see, firstly, that sort of data put into the public domain.
Yeah.
You could probably search around and find out, you know, who'd done a 338 and a 332 and work out who it was. That's not important. It's that they're still a human being. They still have the same physiology and kind of... they might be running considerably faster than the rest of us, but... You know, the rules still apply. There's a lot
that's
more basis
yeah.
needed. And this is only 3.5 minutes. Probably if you went down to athletes that are going, you know, 800 would be similar again, because, you know, you're still talking that 140, 150. But the moment you go down to something like 400, it's completely different.
Yeah.
Because they're only doing 40-something seconds. But this athlete is still, you know, you'd still consider them to be an aerobic athlete. They're still running for, you know, 3.5 minutes. So they need an aerobic base. So they need to be doing 70 miles of running.
There you go.
There we go.
What Joe's been telling you pretty much now for...
Well, no. What's nice is to get different scenarios
yeah,
from
a bit
people
of backup
even
on
down
it.
To that. And the moment it came out...
But you were on it, weren't you?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. I go, right, I want to look at that. I thought it was going to be more pages, actually, when I bought it. I was thinking, oh, what? How much for what?
That's well worth the £355 I've just had to put on it.
No, sadly, it wasn't quite that much. But anyway, there was another thing that popped up, and I tweeted about it, because it's been one of the things that I think... I don't think there's anything in it, and I don't think people should get dragged along. And this is the uncoupled cranks. Yeah. And there's bound to be somebody that sends, you know, some email about this, this, and this. I'm not convinced, but not only that, my opinion isn't important. It's what I read about the research.
Yeah.
And the bulk of things that come out, there was one study back in 2003, you know, it was short-term training, on the
we need to explain cranks. Uncoupled cranks.
So they work independently. So you can press down and they're sort of engaged. But the moment you get to bottom dead center, if you don't actively lift up, the crank's going to stay at the bottom. So you could effectively ride along the road with both knees coming up and down.
Yeah, at the same time.
Look like you're on a horse. Yeah. But you're meant to be working on the upward phase of the lifting, which I could see the element of, okay, it's working on hip flexors, that may help triathletes. There's some people that have touted that it works for them, but there's a lot, 99.999% recurring, that don't use them, that are perfectly effective. And there hasn't been, you know, the one person that has done something so phenomenal in triathlon that people have gone, absolutely.
Yeah,
that, you know,
yeah.
It's not a power measuring system. Okay, they're wrongly called power cranks. Unfortunately, they don't measure power. They just supposedly improve your power by making you actively lift up. Because if you don't, the other leg will still be going round, and hence why they're called uncoupled. They're not linked together, and they don't work exactly together. You have to keep that timing together. And I've worked with people up to elite level that have used them, and have never been convinced, and neither of them, that they're absolutely something they couldn't do without. Power meters, various other things, they've said, got to do it, but they haven't with these. So there was the 2003 study, and then another one popped out. Latest one was in the International Journal of Sports Physiology and Performance, and it was by Burns, and this was published. It's actually been published ahead of it going out on paper, so they sometimes publish them online.
Right.
So it's not actually, so you don't get the full thing, but you just get an abstract of what it is. And they said 5 weeks of training. Okay, you might say, well, 5 weeks ain't long enough.
It's
but
a short period,
the one
yeah.
that was positive was 6 weeks. Well, it can't just happen in that one last week. You know, it all happened in week five. Yeah. Suddenly. They conclude, and they were using trained cyclists. And they said, you know, 5 weeks of training with uncoupled cranks has no effect on economy of motion, efficiency, muscle recruitment, blah, blah, blah. And so somebody said, well, wouldn't it be better? Somebody tweeted and said, yeah, but wouldn't it be better to use untrained people? Well, if they're untrained, they don't need to buy an expensive set of cranks to learn how to get better at riding.
Yeah.
Just get your bike and ride. You know, the people that become most efficient at cycling are the ones that do cycling a lot.
Yeah, but if they were more to the point, if they were untrained, they will see significant gains, regardless of whether they train with those.
But you would then have a control untrained group that were on normal
would do
cranks.
It, yes,
and that
yeah.
group of cyclists, you know, they said that, you know, they were, you know, compared to their training on normal cranks, there was no gain. Okay, it's only 5 weeks, but another study that came out in 2009, again, 6 weeks, 18 sessions of training, does not result in any changes of physiological performance measures in well-trained cyclists. So after a while, there tends to be a trend. And unless you say that, oh, well, it's not 6 weeks, you've got to use it for 66 weeks.
Or, yeah.
Well, it's not really for trained cyclists. It's for, you know, it's for cyclists that have got, you know, poor coordination or whatever. At the moment, it is not a convincing thing to say these things work. They're uncoupled cranks rather than using their, you know, their trade name of power cranks. They're uncoupled cranks and they don't appear to work. There's certainly better places to spend your money. And I always think that there are products. I am associated with Rota, but I also mentioned that there's Osymmetric off-round chain rings. There are, I'm sure, other people that are going to come along with it. You can't ignore that there's competition, but I got associated, I actually first tried Osymmetric before Rota were out and found they worked, and then found the Rota was slightly less severe and worked better, but was on Osymmetrics ages ago saying, I think these work. And if I look a very, 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 very long time ago, I had Biopace
when that
came out
on
my Colnago in 1990. And so, you know, a long time ago. But I'm quite willing to accept that there are things that do work. And after a while, you kind of see that some things might not work as the inventor and the proponents want it to work.
Yeah.
And therefore, it drops by the wayside. If you'd heard or know, through the grapevine, oh yeah, such sort of team, they're definitely using them, they're using this, and it's doing this, isn't this, something in that. When they're not, and they're looking for every, you know, 1-3%, they'd be on it.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't just be that it was, you know, eventually somebody would capture the shot seeing somebody in Omega Pharma or in Sky or in one of the pro, you know, triathlon teams or something using them, saying they're all using it, it's great. And that's what first happened with Rota, was that Sastre used them before his contract supposedly allowed them to use them, but they were worth it, so he did it.
That's right.
And yeah, and after a while, I think there's just trends and they don't appear to work enough. I would put 20 things ahead of that if you're going to spend that sort of money.
Yeah, yeah.
And say, look, use these other things. They're going to give you, you know, far better performance improvements. Sometimes just get the rest of your life sorted out so you ride your bike. Not just these cranks and they do this. And sometimes people do grab at these individual things. You know, they go, oh, yeah, but I've got these power cranks. And they're just like, well, yeah, they might make a little bit of difference. If they do with you, great. But there's still such a minor bit. There's much more to be had for making sure that, you know, the Olympians are already doing the 600, the 1,200 hours of training, whatever it is they're doing.
Yeah.
And some amateurs look for the quick fix to gain 3% and not think, hold on a minute, where am I going to find another 2 hours a week? Because if I do that, I can lock another 100 hours on top of my, you know, annual training amount. And if I can do that and not cause any ructions, not get injured, not, you know, not spend loads more money, that would be the way to do
yeah.
it. But well, it's not sexy saying, I've just got to get up at 5:30 every Saturday morning. That's the way to get another 2 hours. But it is to say, oh, I've got these new super duper doodads.
Yeah, I think that's the thing as well, is you would go, yeah, yeah, I've got these power cranks. So now I can spend that hour that a day that I've got, or an hour every 2 days, you know, doing my bike riding. Well, like you said, why don't you just organise yourself so you're able to get up maybe an hour early, so you have an hour and a half for a couple of days, and then put in an extra kind of hour and a half a week. But yeah, like you said, if it was that big a gain for such an easy thing to kind of put on a bike, then, you know, everybody be doing it.
Everybody be doing it.
So, and the excuse that they're not readily available is rubbish, really, because the pro teams can fork out untold amount of money to be able to get something obscure. So I think
that's why I said, when somebody said, wouldn't it be better to use untrained people, it's like, well, no, that's most of the time, if untrained people don't ride bikes, get them to ride a bike, that'll make them trained, that'll improve them. We're not looking at just to spend money because there's something out there to spend your money on.
Yeah.
I mean, just go and buy some tinsel tassels and put them on your handlebars. They won't make you faster, but hey, spend some money, why not?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
you've got to look for improvements, not just to spend money and say, oh, I've got the usual, you know, the latest doodah. Unless that doodah really does make an improvement. Or, I mean, some people buy things because they say, oh yeah, I've got a new bike, it's really motivating. Well, that's fine, but you don't need to buy uncoupled cranks to get you riding more.
No.
You might just buy better mudguards so you stay drier, or some new some new shoes that don't leak, or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, anyway, there was another one which was interesting for those that want to read it. It's not out yet, but it's the cycling physiology of Miguel Indurain 14 years after retirement.
Really?
Yeah,
well, they did a test.
Yeah, they've done some tests recently in the Basque country.
Oh,
and
right.
Retested him. There is a study, I'm not sure if you can get it or if it's free or whether you'd have to pay. But I've got a study that was done on him just before the hour record, and they measured all of his power. And that's why it's known that he put out around 500 watts for the hour record.
Oh, similar to myself then.
Similar to yourself, yeah. Yes. but he did it for 60 minutes, not 0.6 of a minute.
Whoa, 60 seconds.
Probably couldn't even do that.
And this previous one showed him at his absolute best. And it was really interesting because he was, you know, just phenomenal output. They couldn't put a power meter on him in the hour record because you can't have any measurement system to help you.
Yeah.
But they did so many tests in the lead up, and it talks about his physiology. So that one's out there. And this one is the 14 years after retirement. But even 14 years after retirement.
So is this available to... Is this study available to look at for other people to look at?
The abstract is at the moment because it's an ahead of print. It's ahead of print format, but eventually
don't tell anyone. So everybody just going, well, come on then.
No, it will be eventually.
Yeah.
But I can't remember which journal it's from. But you know, they measured his You know, they measured his, you know, his aerobic power is still 450 watts.
Really?
Yeah.
Sweet Lord.
He's still got a maximum oxygen uptake of 5.29 litres, which is not as high as it would have been at his peak. That's 57 millilitres per kilogram, but he is heavier. He's now 92 kilos, and I think...
He's a big boy, isn't he?
He's a big unit, as they say. But he's 46, 92 kilos. I think I'd worked out from the other thing that at his best he was 82 kilos or something like that.
Yeah.
So about, no, he was less than that. And so he's put on a few kilos, hence his VO2 max at 57 looks low. But, you know, 5.29, considering he's not, you know, he's riding a bit, I think they do, but he's not, I don't think he's uber fit. But yeah, max power is still 450 watts. His lactate threshold is 329 watts. And his, or rather what they call his individual lactate threshold is 329. His actual 4 millimole is 369. But just phenomenal. I mean, they say, you know, his aerobic power declined 12%. His maximum power declined 12% per decade. And Induin's absolute maximal and sub-maximal oxygen uptake and power values still compare favourably with those exhibited by active professional cyclists.
But that...
You know, he can put, so his threshold is, what did I say? His threshold, 4 millimetre onset, 369 watts, which, you know, clearly he would have been way above that. He did 500 watts for the hour record, you know, as best the estimate, you know, might have been 490, but, you know, so he held 490 for 1 hour, so that would have been his threshold. And so you imagine what his peak power output must have been then.
Oh, I wouldn't you just give money to be able to kind of take him back to his prime and put him in today's kit and today's technology with today's bikes and just see how well he went?
Well, he proved that in the hour record, didn't he? I mean, you know, and he run the tour 5 times, so you don't need to do it now. You just need to say, look what he did then.
Well, it's funny, actually, because my tutor at school used to be into cycling. He was massively into it.
Is this story going to take a while?
No.
Okay.
And I remember reading a study on his wall that he did, because he was a biology teacher.
Did you read it, or was it read to you?
No. I read this and everything. And it was saying about the size of his lungs, of Miguel Indurain's lungs, and how big they were. And
they were as big as a tennis court.
Yeah, they were massive. But it was funny. It's funny how things kind of stick in your mind. I mean, I don't remember anything else from school.
No, I don't remember anything else. Miguel Indurain's lungs.
Miguel Indurain's were massive. And yeah, and the fact that my tutor used to ride a pink and white Colnago Master. That was it. Isn't it funny?
Okay.
What a nice chat.
So, yeah, it's called The Cycling Physiology of Miguel Indurain, 14 years after retirement. Can't remember the journal, but when it comes out in full print, I'll put the I'll put the link to the abstract out there. If you want to get the full print one, you'll obviously have to pay. And some of these are, you know, 20 quid. Some of them are 40.
£20,
some of them,
Joseph.
£40 per
study. I can't even read half the words on it. But no, that's actually that's interesting for considering he's how old was he? 40. 46 now, I was going
to say. He's a year older than me. See, I didn't... At the
I tell you what, the Spanish know how to live, don't they? You've had a hell of a paper round.
Thanks. The other one, which we won't bore you anymore, there was a sleep research one that is on the Twitter feed. So if you go to twitter.com...
Read that.
Twitter.com/coachjoebeard. Just a little bit of insight into sleep and its effect on performance. But also, there was this, again, beetroot juice. But this was done by a group, a kind of group of groups, Maastricht University, Karolinska Institute in Stockholm, and McMaster University in Ontario in Canada. And they looked at well-trained cyclists. Okay, and they looked at 1 hour time trial after already riding for 2.5 hours. So somebody obviously overdid their warm up for the time trial, didn't they?
It's outrageous, isn't it?
Say, who does a 2.5 hour warm up for their time trial?
Have you done your 2.5 hours? Yeah, hour time trial. You're having a laugh.
No, it's a way to kind of pre-exhaust and then look at a performance test better. Mm. It's often done in these sort of things. Anyway, the actual test was on a single dose of beetroot juice. Okay, so. It was actually a nitrate-rich beetroot juice. There we go. 140 millilitres of it. So is that one of those little... Are they 140
No, they're 75, aren't they?
Okay. But anyway, that was what they did. And looked at the plasma nitrate, so that's the effect that it should have, and it definitely went up. It was 530 when they took the beetroot. It was only 271 when they'd taken nothing.
Really?
So it was, you know, very roughly double. But the time trial performance did not differ. Okay. They took it, and I was just trying to check, using double blind crossover, so they, you know, the washout period. They took the beetroot with breakfast 2.5 hours before the time trial. Okay. So the classic thing is to take it 2.5 hours before. But this single dose didn't improve 1 hour time trial performance. So, you know, whether this is just it's a 2012 study, so it is it's another the group who's headed by one person has done a study that shows it does work. So maybe there's a difference, and one of the differences is I know one of the other studies they've done, they did 6 days.
Yeah, loading.
And I think if I could bet on it, I'd say don't just do one dose, just plan back. If it's an important race, do at least 6 doses leading up to it. This was a, you know, a nitrate rich beetroot juice. A lot of people just use standard beetroot juice, half a liter per day. I say with your biggest meals, it's got a better chance of, you know, hanging around in your stomach. Some people that drink it on an empty stomach have some funny
really
issues.
I was just going to ask you, do you have people that have any funny side effects?
Yes.
With it?
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, but I think they might have it on an empty stomach, and therefore I think it just, you know, sometimes it causes rather disturbing flatulence.
Really?
Yes. Yes, that has a red colour to it as well as a strange sound. I jest not. But anyway, you know, they've said about, you know, they did other stuff on 500ml stuff, but they're looking... however, large amounts of beetroot juice doesn't represent a realistic dietary strategy for athletes to follow in a practical performance-based setting. Well, I think it is.
I was going to say,
I don't see the difficulty. No. I actually quite like drinking half a litre of beetroot juice. It's another thing to drink. It's another, you know, another form of liquid. I don't see that it is difficult. People are always trying to make things simple and condense it down to, you know, a tiny little shot or whatever.
Yeah.
I have... plenty of people using it that don't have issues with it. You've just got to plan back. I don't think the key is to say, oh, I'll just take one, you know, 2.5 hours before. No, because there's much better and stronger and more reproduced research on 6 days. Okay, and you've got to buy, therefore, 6 halves. You've got to buy, you know, 3 litres of beetroot juice and take the last half a litre 2.5 hours before you start. Then you've got it all rolled into one then.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I...
But there's still some twists to it, but that's going to come out when I... do the fact sheet.
Well, it can't keep us in suspense, Joseph.
Oh, of course it can. So we are coming up to... what's that, Martin? Is that just over an hour?
That is 1 hour. And
that is 1 hour.
8 minutes.
Oh, yeah. Just checking back on the predictions. I predicted 57 to 64 medals, and I put 65.
Can't remember
what you said. No, I didn't write it down.
Not that important, really, is it?
No. So, come on, what's your technology tip for people out there that maybe doesn't have to do with bikes?
Nothing to do with bikes.
Heart monitors, GPS,
I tell you
Strava,
one thing.
You name it.
One thing that has infuriated me the Olympics.
Right, let me just drag the soapbox out.
Yeah.
There's the soapbox, get on it then.
The one thing that has infuriated me is almost a stifling of technology.
Ooh.
With that.
Why is that then?
Well, because things like certain sponsorship, the IOC stopped certain people using certain sponsored brands, or all the brands had to be basically taped out or blacked out.
Really?
Yeah, they stopped them using from particular things because of sponsorship.
No way.
But what country was it? The Swedish that had those orange aero helmets. Was it the Swedish or the
It was the Netherlands, I think.
Yeah. My...
I know a few things about those helmets.
Those aero helmets. Now, they're not... I was sat here pointing at Joe. No. I don't know. I've got a feeling I've seen these helmets before.
No, I don't think you have. No, you're not thinking. You're not thinking that's my Darth Vader.
Yeah, that's what I
said. No, it's not. No.
Or did the guy that was sat in the control panel for the Death Star, didn't he have one on?
I'll tell you what it looks like. If people have got kids and their kids watch Cars, the movie, but there was a spin-off called Cars Toons, which are these little, like, three-minute ones, right. And there's a UFO on one of them, and it looks like that helmet. Oh, I looked at it and thought, that's Mate, and his name's Mator, for those that want to know the technical. His name's Mator, and he's a UFO. There we go.
But that was the thing that irritated me.
Yeah.
And technology, again, on a branch of technology, was the use of wheels in the velodrome.
That infuriates you. Not wheels.
Infuriates me. They're supposed to be talented.
You're not allowed to use one.
No. But Chris Borman made an interesting comment.
Right.
The French were moaning, that the wheels that the English were using were the new special wheels that no one had ever seen.
Yeah.
Bearing in mind they're made by a French company.
Mavic.
Yeah. And Borman made an interesting fact, which I might have got wrong.
Sorry about this. Yeah. Martin's going to get it wrong.
But he either said that it's exactly the same wheels that they've used in Beijing or Atlanta. I couldn't remember which one he said.
Oh, it must be Beijing.
It's got to be Beijing. Yeah. But he said, funny enough, they're moaning about the wheels being these new special wheels. He says they are the exactly same, exact identical same ones that they used in Beijing.
Right. Because I saw a few things about... you know, people saying they were quickly put into bags and stuff like that. Now, maybe we saw them with tights on to keep their legs warm, you know, with these these warmed tights to keep their legs warm. You know, maybe they were doing smart things, and the reason why they rushed them into bags was that they were actually keeping them warm or something.
Yeah.
You know, they said, oh, they were very quick at putting them away in bags. Yeah, it might have been the tyres that they had on there. I don't think they could have used something that wasn't prior...
I don't think they're allowed to.
It's got to be UCI tested. But it may be that the brand of tyre, or they had something on them that they didn't want other people to see.
Another interesting comment that two people made. Chris Borman obviously helps the guys out with the cycling, with their aerodynamics.
Squirrel Club.
Yeah. And David Brailsford said that exactly the same thing, and that was they are round.
Yes.
And somebody thought it was a flippant comment. You know, Chris Borman went, yeah, I've got a special one. They're round. And then Brailsford said exactly the same. And the lady interviewing him chuckled. And he went, no, they are round. Perfectly round. And she went, oh, right. So whether he meant that the wheels to the nth degree were as bang round and as bang true as you could get them, or the way the tyres were put on made them absolutely flush bang.
Maybe, and I don't know whether it's heresy to suggest, maybe they were on clinchers, who knows? I don't know.
That's made me sick to the stomach, Joseph.
Well, I don't know. I mean,
getting
tubs perfectly round has always been the issue.
Yeah.
And it's why there are data, and there are certainly people doing research now on clinchers, which will outdo tubulars.
Yeah.
They will outperform them. And I don't know, but, you know, but perhaps that was the thing. I didn't see the wheels up close, but perhaps when the wheels were actually, you know, moving, they were a bit, you know, they weren't, you know, they were clinchers. I don't know. Perhaps you couldn't have clinchers on track. I don't know. But maybe that was the reason they had a different version of it.
Yeah.
You know, and therefore that's why they're perfectly round. They were saying we're on clinchers, not on tubs. I don't know, but that's what appeared to me at the time. Why say that? Well, the only way you get them perfectly round is to have them on a clincher, not on a tube.
But it was just an interesting kind of almost like scenario to it, almost soap.
You'd have to get some real close-up pictures of anyone that's taken them of the bikes and of the bikes in the TT, in the TT in the Olympics and see.
But people were right. The kit wasn't hanging about a lot, was it? If you know what I mean, they rode them to the centre of the track.
You couldn't see inside their warm-up.
No.
Before the TT, other people could see them out there doing it, and they weren't. And I wonder whether they were, because once a bike's rolling, it's really difficult to work out what tyres or what. You can always brand out stuff with a marker or whatever. But I wonder whether there was something that they had in. Perhaps it was clinchers. Perhaps it was a certain brand of tyre. You know, some of the other brands, which are mouth and name to you. are working on
some... Whoa, you can't call me. Yeah, but yeah.
But they're working on some things that, you know, might change the way you look at it. Well, we know that one of the issues with tubulars is they're not perfectly round.
Yeah.
And a clincher can be made perfectly round. So perhaps
please don't be right, because this will go back to the age-old argument that we have. When you turn around and went, clinchers. No messing, clinchers. It's always been clinchers. As you said, clinchers. 2013, I've seen snippets of bits and bobs. There's probably people on the internet that spend a bit of time on the internet have probably seen a little bit more than I have.
Right.
But I know with the certain brands that we deal with, we've got new workbooks. So it's the books that the dealers, the shops get. We've seen them. We've seen the pricing structures for them as well. So kind of three of the major brands that we deal with, we've seen most of the new bikes already. Mm. So everything.
And that's what we'll start seeing in the next couple of months, won't we?
Oh, it'll be
Interbike, Eurobike. Somebody I deal with is off to your bike. There'll be pictures coming back from that. They've got this, got that. And pictures, the thing is, you only ever see the stuff that they want you to see.
Yeah, the pictures will come back, and I'll know for a fact that we will then get umpteen phone calls saying, "Seen it on the internet. Can you get it?"
Yeah.
No, it's not going to be ready till the new year.
Yeah.
Ugh, right. Yeah. But you know, things like that. What else have we seen that we know of at the minute? I think that's pretty much it.
Well, tweet about it. When you find out about something, you tweet it, and I'll retweet.
All right.
But most of it, there's unlikely to be revelations, is there? Most of it is going to be, you know, a slight improvement on, you know, this particular wheel set or this helmet, or this is now lighter, or this has now got better puncture protection, or this has now got bigger sizes or whatever.
But with reference to technology, I had an interesting conversation with a gent saying that he said, "Oh, don't you think it's a bit mysterious that we're being drip fed this technology in the bike industry, you know, with being consumers?" And I said, "Well, not really, no." He said, like the new electronic gears. I said, well, they came out 15 years ago. Mavic had a setup which was completely wireless that they used to have.
22 years ago.
Is it that? It can't be that far. It can't be.
It is. I saw a guy with a vocal system that he spoke to it.
It's not a
in
chance.
In a bike shop.
You've made that up.
In a bike shop in Nice in 1992. And he had a bike, a carbon fibre bike, and it had... carbon Karima aero bars.
Yeah.
And it had this little thing, and he spoke to it, and the rear...
One board egg.
No, he spoke to
it. And it shifted.
And it shifted. He had a Mechtronic. It wasn't even Mavic Mechtronic. It was before Mechtronic.
Yeah.
Right? And he spoke to it, and it moved. And it was wizardry.
Yeah. Because I remember the Mavic system coming out, and I remember the conversation... In, I think it was Cycling Weekly that I was reading, saying that the pros won't use it because it's not trustworthy,
which
was fair enough. But it was just an interesting conversation with this guy going, do you think we're being drip-fed this, you know, slowly feeding it in? I said, well...
No, it's been R&D, doesn't it? You've got to test it. Yeah.
That's what I said. I said, they've had the technology. So he was going, well, do you think they've just released a bit at a time? I said, well, you have to be fair. If there's such a substantial jump in, say, one season... You're going to have a block of three seasons where people go, well, there's nothing new to buy. Yeah.
It's
I don't
not
know
like
why
a mobile where you think, look, we've got to release it slowly or people are going to get blown away by the technology.
Yeah.
You still only press this button or this button. Yeah. There's always conspiracies out there.
Yeah. But it's just, I think technology now, I think you've got to, you know, people like Shimano are reaching a bit of a plateau now with 11-speed electronic. I know Campag do their EPS.
Have you not seen the 19-speed?
Yeah, this is what's going to happen, though, isn't it? But... you'll get to a point where not a lot else can change.
No, no.
But then if you think we've come from round tubes to now aero tubes, from slightly deep section wheels to proper deep section carbon fibre wheels. So, you know, things have progressed on quite nicely, but I think things in cycling and triathlon will have to change to be able to incorporate a bit more technology just to allow things to move on a bit more. So
there'll come a point where and I'm sure it's been done, you won't have a gear shifting system. The power meter will work out your torque and it will change for you.
Gear
and
for
it'll
you,
be
yeah.
right. I don't want to go above, you know, 5 watts per rev or whatever that torque is. And I don't want to go below 1.5 or I'm pressing thin air. I want to be in that range the whole time.
Yeah.
And whatever you do, it it varies it accordingly, depending on what's just about to come up, because it can work it out from the GPS.
Yeah.
What's coming up? Right, we're going to gear down the fraction of the second sooner than your legs want to do it, because then you'll have continual kind of effort. If you do it and suddenly hit a ramp, it's going to surge and then stop and surge and then stop. And that would be just about doing the right algorithm, taking, you know, think what cars do now, several thousand per second can work out what's going on a bike. It's going to be a piece of cake.
But that's what I was saying to you about having a GPS computer, where you can actually do the ride on a normal bike, and then you say to yourself, right, I want to do it slower, quicker, less, you know, heart rate lower. You can then plug it into a diagnostics, into a computer program that sets all your gears up, sets the torque system up. So when you're riding it, it's just shifting to make it
easier.
And
for the listeners that were trying to do the JBST podcast, you've now tuned into Tomorrow's World.
Yeah, you've now tuned in to Martin Crocker's Lunatic Hour. The man is a buffoon.
Right, I think we've probably gone as far
but
as
yeah,
we can.
But yeah, technology, as soon as I hear or
when
know
you do it, you tweet it. Because I know it's always, sometimes it's just interesting to see how things are going and to see the integration of electronic and aero and aero road bikes and aero road helmets and stuff. And it doesn't stop, because it won't stop. The innovations don't hit a plateau, because people want to keep going faster. And as some sports get cleaner, they have to look for technology to find a few bits here and there.
Yeah.
And you know, if you look at the bikes now and look back even, you know, even 10 years ago, to look at the bikes now from the aerodynamics, from the off round chain rings, from the electronic shifting, you know, from the hydration systems and the aero helmets. I mean, it's just, it's light. It's what you'd have thought of, wow, that's some special Olympic bike that's a one-off.
Yeah.
Now, you can roll out of a bike shop on stuff that is just amazing.
I think so.
Good. You keep us up to date, won't you?
I'll try.
Okay, thank you very much for listening. This is the September issue, so this will go out towards the back end of August, and then there'll be another one 3 to 4 weeks later. We don't have to do it too often, do we, Martin?
No. And I think we should do another one of our little question. We did one, didn't we? I think it was, is it in winter that we did it, where we just had
Q&As?
Just Q&As, that's all we had.
Yeah. So.
So none of Joe's papers that he buys for £20?
Okay, go to contact us with your questions. Click contact at coachjoebeer.com. Newsletter going out in the next week when this goes out. Twitter feed, mine is twitter.com/coachjoebeer, and Martin's is twitter.com/safewhatracing.
That's the one.
Yeah. iTunes, please leave your reviews, your ratings, and subscribe so you get this automatically. And once again, thank you for listening. This has been a bumper-packed issue.
Yes.
It's after 10 o'clock at night.
It's a pleasant evening. Well, right?
It started as a pleasant sunny evening, and it's now gone to the darkness. And it's quite nice, actually. It's kind of different to when you do it in the morning and the light gradually comes in. It's quite nice to kind of be, you know,
Slowing it down. I've now got to go home, pack my car for 2 weeks away in the south of France.
Yes. Yeah. So if you're in the south of France, beware.
Yeah, I will be in the Pyrenees for 4 or 5 days and then back to the coast.
Sorry, Martin. Yeah. You'll have a wonderful time, won't you?
I will.
Be thinking of you. All right.
30 degrees.
More like 40 degrees, I think.
Yeah, you might find.
Yeah. So, everybody, remember, train smart, have fun, and we'll talk to you in a month.
A month?
One, two. You don't have to put your hand. You don't have to literally eat the thing. Hello, testing. 1, 2, 3.
Is that like a bit of tight? Is that like tights? Ladies' tights that they've...